In 1957, Sergei Korolev, the father of the Soviet space program, proclaimed after the launch of Sputnik 1, "The road to the stars is open." Video game mogul Richard Garriott would give a whole new meaning to that statement of 50 years later when he became a space tourist, although it did cost him some $30 million. Mr. Garriott's journey into orbit is the subject of filmmaker Mike Wolff's new documentary called Man on a Mission. It opens today at Cinema Village, and I'm very pleased that it brings Mike and Richard to our show today. Hello.
Hey, thank you very much for having us.
Nice to be here.
So, Richard, your father is an astronaut. Your mother is a professional artist. Were you faced with a choice when you were a kid between wanting to go into space or making art?
Interestingly, I found a primary career, which is really both. I make computer games as my main career, and I find that as the quintessential high-tech art. And so, therefore, I think I threaded the needle pretty well.
But the reason that you couldn't even apply was because of your eyesight?
Exactly. When I was about 13 years old, one of the NASA doctors, who was our family doctor, mentioned offhandedly that because I needed glasses, I was no longer eligible to be an astronaut.
Now, why can't you wear glasses or contact lenses and go into space?
Well, it primarily has to do with they want to make sure your vision is perfect during particularly hazardous times like launch and reentry. And as it turns out, in space, the pressure inside your eye does go up by often as much as 50%, and so
you don't want to have glaucoma.
Right. In fact, actually, in theory, it could make glaucoma worse, or bring on glaucoma, actually. And so vision is an important issue. But strangely, since I'm the first person who's flown in space who's had corrective eye surgery, NASA studied my eyes as the first and only test case of what that would be like. And based on those results and other things NASA was doing, that's now approved. So you actually can fly now with corrective surgery.
But you did grow up in this culture. Your father was an astronaut.
Yeah.
And the first astronaut to take a ham radio into space?
That's right. My father, 25 years, almost to the day before my flight, he took the first ham radio, so he talked to the general public. Prior to my father's flight, astronauts only spoke to mission control. But since my father's flight, that's now a custom that's quite standard, is there's always a ham radio on board the spacecraft.
So you couldn't become an astronaut, which was your fantasy, and you say you started programming computer games. Is that a logical move?
It really just sort of happened, you might say, for me. I was just at the right age at the right time when personal computers first came out. And so I'm a self-taught programmer and designer. And was really one of the very first people ever to publish computer games.
How old were you when you started?
I started writing at the age of about 14.
You were making money as a kid.
Yeah. In fact, my first published title came out at the age of 19 and was just as I was entering college. And, a funny way I like to note it is that my first game, which took me only a few weeks of after-school time, earned me more than double my father's astronaut salary. So it was clearly a good idea.
Were they resentful, your parents?
Oh, not at all. it was a much more interesting time when, as my income level went up and my college grade point average went down, and I had to get family permission to drop out of school to go play games for a living, which is what I basically did. But even that, they were extremely supportive of. It was obvious that this new industry was the way to go.
You coined the term massively multiplayer online role-playing game.
Yeah, that's a... With the advent of the internet, that allowed games to, instead of just playing by yourself alone at home, it allows everyone at the same time to connect through the internet and play together.
And when you sold your company, Origin, to Electronic Arts, did you think you would spend the money on travel?
Well, I'm a big modern interpretation of explorer, you might say, in the sense I'd already pre-space traveled to Antarctica and the Titanic and all kinds of extreme places.
You go in the submarine down
exactly.
To the Titanic?
In fact, I'm a participant in the one of the shareholders of the companies that do things like take people down to the Titanic or into the interior of Antarctica, just like I am one of the founders and shareholders of the company, the only company that currently sends people into space.
Mike, when did you come into this story?
I came into this story about 8 months before Richard went up into space. I approached him at a wedding, and I'd known Richard a little bit through Austin. We travel in some of the same circles, and asked him, "Hey, is anybody documenting this, Richard?"
But your previous films had mostly been about food, hadn't they?
There was a little bit of food. There's a little bit of beard growing contest. I think a little bit more of the obscurities that go on.
And this is a big project.
Biggest that we've ever undertaken. In a lot of ways, we say this is the most expensive documentary ever made because it cost $30 million for Richard to go up.
Well, you didn't have to kick in any of that money, did you?
He has not asked so far. Thank goodness.
But it was an investment, nonetheless, amongst the team.
It did give you an opportunity to go into the Russian space program, which is rather secretive, isn't it?
It was rather secretive, and it was absolutely fascinating to see how much they've been able to achieve and yet how little we're able to hear about it.
At the same time, it looks like it's both beautiful and a decaying place.
I think that's actually what makes it so beautiful, is that it's almost like the way you imagine space travel should be, with big shiny knobs and fancy helmets.
Yeah, well, it looks like something out of a science fiction film, something that Ridley Scott might have put into a movie. Richard, who did you first approach about buying a seat on a space mission? In the early days, of course, you couldn't even think along those lines, could you?
Well, even with the first monies I made out of my first games, I began to try to invest in a private route to get into space, since NASA had told me no. I invested in a company called Spacehab that tried to put basically a double-decker bus in the back of the shuttle, but they actually flew their cargo modules, but NASA said no to taking civilians.
And what was the reason? They just felt the risk was too high?
No, they actually just said that's not part of our mandate. You know, our congressional mandate is for science and research and exploration. It really has nothing to do with the general public. And so even though it would have worked, and this company, Spacehab, really did fly those modules for scientific purposes, NASA just denied their request to be able to send civilians.
Could have made some extra money.
Offset some of the cost, exactly.
So you went to Russia instead.
Exactly. And
their program was taking over anyway.
Well, what's interesting is when we first opened, Dennis Tito was our first client, sadly. It was actually originally supposed to be me, but that was when the internet stock market crashed, so I sold my first seat to Dennis Tito.
Now, that first seat cost you $20 million.
That's right.
Your second seat cost you $30 million.
That's right.
Is this an inflationary business?
Yes, and sadly, it's continued to go up even since my flight, mostly because the dollar has fallen and the ruble has risen. The good news is that we think we're past the peak, and the price will start coming down now over the next decade, to where I really am quite bullish that whether you call it space tourism or the future of what I'll call commercial activity in space, even whether it's mining asteroids or biological research, those things are all now finally coming to what I'll call profitability here in the next era.
If your business hadn't lost so much money, that was during the dot-com crash.
Mm-hmm.
Would you have been the first
Yep.
non-astronaut in space?
Yep.
Wow. So,
So obviously it was a crushing blow to, having already put so much into it, to have to turn around and sell that first seat. But I circled back, built another company, built some more games, earned some more money, and ultimately did fly.
Well, it timed out really well, too, because I wasn't around there. So we wouldn't have been able to document it as intricately as were able to.
Did you hear about it by reading about it in the newspaper? Oh, you said you were at a wedding, but that's not when you learned about it.
When you live in Austin, you sort of always know what Richard's doing, whether it's a haunted house or going to space and following his father. So we were pretty aware of the journey that was about to take place.
But it was really funny at that wedding when we met. As you might imagine, arranging for a space flight is a pretty overwhelming task that you have to plan years in advance while you're also gainfully employed in a very competitive business. And so you don't really have much time to think about other things like documenting your own trip. And so when Mike came up to me and said, Richard, surely by now you've thought about this. And I paused for a moment and went, actually, no. I just haven't, it hasn't even crossed my mind. But you're absolutely right that this is a incredibly important, not just for me to document, but the fact that we really are breaking open civilian spaceflight now for the first time ever.
But you can't just show up the day before and get fitted for a spacesuit.
No. There's
a lot of physical stuff that you have to get through. Have to be fitted for a seat.
Yeah, well, I started about 2 years out, and my first full year was almost entirely medical preparation, including they found a liver anomaly that I had to surgically remove. So I have a 16-inch scar across my belly as one of my mementos of this journey.
The film reviewer in the New York Times wrote today, what's odd about it is that while you can certainly sense the joy that this fellow Richard Garriott feels in achieving a lifelong dream, you're definitely unlikely to be interested in imitating him. Cramped quarters, bulky wardrobe, unappetizing-looking food. It seems like a worst vacation ever candidate.
Well, there's a lot of great reasons to go to space, but the sleeping arrangements and the food are, and the toilets for that matter, are not part of it.
And you had to learn to speak Russian?
Сейчас я знаю русский язык. Очень много.
It sounds difficult to learn.
Yeah,
especially when you're old.
But you know, since the spacecraft is all labeled in Russian and the instruction manuals, the flight data files are in Russian and the commands for mission control are in Russian, you better learn a little bit of Russian or you'd have a hard time.
So, Mike, you go there accompanying him. You're his kind of his posse with a film crew?
Very much so. A three-person posse with three cameras, sometimes four, two in each hand.
Were you worried about his safety? You know, if this thing goes wrong, all of the work that you've done up to this point is for naught, isn't
it? Well, actually, it would have been a very interesting ending. No, there's no question.
Been problems with the Soyuz.
There had been problems with the Soyuz. At the time, I felt it was for his moment when he actually launched and we're all there and we watch his Soyuz going up into space. And there's no question, in the back of your head, you hear this voice saying, don't blow up. Please don't blow up. Don't blow up. And that's the first time I actually personally felt the danger that he was going through.
Now, where were you living while he was going through his training?
We were in Austin, and we would coordinate our trips to Russia and then to Kazakhstan to take care of the filming.
Mm-hmm. And you had to film his training and and then gave him the camera to take on board?
Exactly. Gave him that in the instruction manual and sent him on his way.
Well, you had to take a final exam, didn't you? What would have happened if you hadn't passed?
The exams are for real, so to speak. If you don't pass, you don't fly. However, the training is extraordinarily thorough, and there was little doubt by the time the exams came around that we would pass without difficulty. The training that was actually the hardest was what's called open sea survival training, and we actually did not pass our first time through the open sea survival training, the training crew that I was with.
That's going into water and
they'll actually take a capsule, put you in your spacesuits, throw the capsule in the ocean. And then you have to all three of you have to change out of your space suits into open sea survival suits inside that little crammed vessel and get out before the whole thing overheats, which we failed to do the first time.
But you're here to tell the tale.
But I am here to tell the tale. So, the reason why is because the doctors stopped the simulation. We'd actually swallowed core body temperature probes. And after about an hour and a half, you're supposed to be able to do this in about 20 minutes. And so after about an hour and a half, we not only had not finished, but our core body temperatures had raised to the point where they stopped the simulation.
And then you did it a second time and passed.
Well, then overnight, we practiced, and the next day we did it in basically record time, as we did for two more attempts.
Now, Mike, the visuals are quite lovely here. How do you even choose camera angles for something like this? Well, you start off with the camera panning through this incredible facility.
Sure. I mean, I think
wonderful colors.
The approach that we took was just to make this the story is so epic, the first son of an astronaut to go to space. So I think when it came time to turn our cameras on it, you just wanted to make everything seem as big as it really is.
How long were you in the International Space Station?
Just about 2 weeks.
So you have to dock?
Oh, yeah. In fact,
you weren't part of that process, were you? Were the regular
cosmonauts
there?
No, but the thing about the Soyuz is there are no passenger seats. In fact, you know, it's interesting that while the term space tourist is used fairly broadly for me and my six friends who have done this kind of flight, first of all, there is no tourist seat. Everyone has operations to do or that are critical to the success of the flight and the safety of the crew. Additionally, though, for myself, I took on a very heavy scientific and commercial task list, you might say. And so I would argue that I actually did more science and commercial activity than any nominal professional astronaut or cosmonaut. So I was a very much an integral part of the crew.
And you're also thinking about this as a future business proposition.
As a business, exactly.
Now, most astronauts tell us that the best part of space travel is looking through the window and seeing Earth from...
That's absolutely right. You know, my father told me that as well. In fact, he helped me plan each of my daily schedules with specific times set aside to be at the window that he knew would be so important.
Were you able to maintain contact with Richard while he was up there?
A little bit. He would call down each day from the space station to Russian Mission Control, and we left Brady, our producer, there to speak to him each day to talk about what he'd filmed and what was coming up.
I don't want to spoil it, but Richard got some incredible footage of re-entering the Earth's atmosphere.
You
must have been overjoyed when you saw it.
Oh, absolutely. I don't think you can oversell or feel like you're giving it away. When Richard says the best view is from looking out the window from the space station, I think the best thing he brought down was this view inside the capsule during reentry. Typically, that's the part of the movie where you have radio silence and you wait for John Glenn to start whistling.
It's actually interesting. That particular footage, you know, there's some very early Mercury footage showing reentry. But, you know, that's all 40 years old, you know, approximately. This was actually the first time that reentry from the inside of a space capsule has been filmed in modern times. And it turns out because it's both it's difficult and tricky to do.
Now, I have very little time, but if I decide I want to go up there, how much is it going to cost me now?
Today, it'll cost you $50 million to go. Although we can also take you to the moon, by the way, for about $150.
Man on a Mission opens today at Cinema Village, and Richard Garriott and Mike Wolff will be taking part in a Q&A session at the 520 and 720 screenings. Cinema Village is at 22 East 12th Street. Mike Wolff and producer Brady Dial will be doing a Q&A session at the 720 screening tomorrow night. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.